everybody, and welcome back to another special edition of Ancient Future Faith. My name is Chris Alford, and on the line with me today is my very dearest friend in all the world, Dr. Carl Peters. Hey, Carl, and welcome.
Hi, Dr. Chris. So good to be with you today.
Well, we just spent a whole bunch of time together. Is it, have a few days enough gone by that we can stand being with one another again?
It was a glorious trip, and I know we probably should do something like that again. I don't know that it'll be the Holy Land, but it's a joy to travel with you. And we had our wives with us and 35 or six other folks, and it was a wonderful time in the Holy Land.
It really was. Carl is with me today to talk about our recent trip to the Holy Land, and we promised the folks who went on the trip that we would do a series of podcasts to, go back and reminisce a bit, but also try to recapture at least some of the teaching that we did while we were there. Because as you have said before, Carl, when you're over there and you're getting this gush of information, it's almost like drinking out of a fire hose, right? It's hard to keep up with everything.
It really is. And I think it'll be good to have a place people can go to refresh their memories and relive some of the moments that we shared. They were wonderful, wonderful days. It was like Christmas every day as we unpacked holy site after holy site, places we've studied about since we were children, many of us. And it was a glorious time to be together and discovering these things and sharing in these beautiful experiences.
We probably ought to say, for the folks who are just listening in and were not on the trip, we just returned. Well, we're recording this, let's see, on the 28th of March. And we were together with a group of a total of 39 folks in the Holy Land, March 1 through 13. And Carl, you and I had been a few years ago together and even started thinking about, hey, what would a return trip look like?
October of 2018 was our first trip to the Holy Land. We've talked about this for several years. It finally came to pass and we were able to go. I was sort of a guest of your group in that first experience. And I don't remember how many we had. It was a wonderful trip. And even as soon as we arrived back, you and I began to discuss the thought of returning to the Holy Land, returning to experience some of those things again.
Well, and then the Rona hits, right? And just the whole world was on lockdown. So it wasn't going to be especially easy to get back. And there was a time there where Israel had even those mask protocols and testing and vaccine requirements that some folks didn't want to have to jump through that hoop. So it took us a little time, but we finally got there, Carl.
Yeah, they totally shut down the country. We had made plans. We came up with what we thought was a fantastic itinerary and had folks ready to go. And we had to postpone, I think, twice, so that when the time finally arrived, our appetites were surely whetted for this experience.
Yeah, we were ready. This was a bit of a logistical issue, although we can't take credit for so much of the overall logistics. John Brown at the Obed Project in Charlotte, North Carolina, is just an absolute miracle worker. And we had three groups, one from Sacramento. We had a separate group flying out from Knoxville, Tennessee, and then your group actually started in Lexington and then bussed over to Louisville. So we've got, Carl, three groups of at least 12 people. I think my group was 11. You had 14. Knoxville was 12. We had all of those folks flying at different times and converging in Tel Aviv within 20 minutes of each other. That was a minor miracle right there.
It was a tremendous miracle. And when we arrived, we were met by folks that John had arranged to meet each group, if I'm not mistaken, this is right, that led us through that process of entering the country, going through all of the processing, the security checkpoints, and so forth. We waltzed through that in no time. And again, we have to say thank you to John and Obed for the wonderful work they did. When the young man met my group, his sign read Peters Alford. And I so appreciated
clearly
the
a mistake
way that he put that. It was fabulous, and it was great. You know, you think about all of those TV shows where you see somebody at the airport being met, and there they are holding their
with
name
the sign
out there.
Yeah,
and you want that to happen to you at some point in your life, and it happened, and I was overjoyed.
It was wonderful to reunite with everybody. And we had had a couple of Zoom meetings along the way, and we had prepared a pictorial directory of everybody. Although I have to say, some people had sent me pictures of what they looked like in about 1987, so I had a hard time identifying.
I think a few of them sent senior pictures from high school.
That explains the shag haircuts and the wings. Yes, yeah, now I get
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. Well, Carl, this itinerary was a little different than the one we put together before, and I have to say I preferred it for a couple of reasons. Let's talk about that in general terms for half a jiffy, and then I guess maybe for this podcast, we'll talk about the first brief overnight and then what we did on the first day, which was packed. But the difference, Carl, talk about that a little bit, would you, between this itinerary and the one that we did last time we were there together?
Well, one of our express purposes was to have more time at these sacred sites so that it wouldn't be a rush in, take a picture, head back to the bus, and off you go. There were some frustrating moments where we just didn't have enough time to really sit and ponder and pray and meditate in the various places we visited in 2018. So as we put this itinerary together, we decided to narrow it down to two regions in the country. We were excluding going over into Jordan and doing the Petra experience, which is fabulous, and going to the southern part of the country with Eilat at the Red Sea and cutting out the Timna National Park and the Tabernacle that they have out in the wilderness. They have a model of a tabernacle. We did that last year, but those are commitments of whole days just to get there.
Yeah.
So we cut those things out, even though they were wonderful. And we focused our attention really on the region of the Galilee and then also Jerusalem. Those were our two focal points. And Chris, I have to say, I think we did the right thing. We had such wonderful experiences in both places. We split up the time roughly 50-50, I think a little more time in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But that was our goal, and I think we did a good job.
Agree. And it's a trade-off, isn't it? If you're going to go do that thing, then it's going to affect how much time you spend at this other thing. So we decided, you know what, the Dead Sea and going there for a night or two, or say up to Masada, those are wonderful experiences, but we knew, because we had been there before, and of course we had the help of our trusty and very wise and learned and experienced friend, Dr. Teresa Gardner, with us, we knew that if we trade off A and B, we'll be able to do C and D, and it really worked out well. One specific thing is, the last time we went, and this had been recommended to us, and I don't regret it, but we went immediately from the airport at Tel Aviv, driving, a couple of hours, maybe not quite that much, but over to the Dead Sea and checking into a hotel very late and then having to get up very early in the next morning. This time, Carl, we landed at Tel Aviv at 4:20 local time, again, within 20 minutes of each other. We took a little short walk over to the bus, and then after 20 minutes or so, we were at our hotel and relaxing. And I got to tell you, maybe it's my age because we're 5 years older now, but I really enjoyed just getting to the hotel quickly. Did you have that feeling?
That was lovely. It was great not to have the long bus ride. We went to the hotel. Now, I must confess that there was almost a party going on out in the grassy knoll between our hotel and the Mediterranean. It was getting dark, but the party was just starting. So my wife, who's 6 years younger than I, said, "Hey, let's go see what's going on." So we didn't just relax. We went out into this great party of young people waving their Israeli flags or some kind of rally or something. And there was a DJ playing some tunes up there. But we walked along the waterfront together and just trying to recognize the fact that we were in the Holy Land. We were in Israel. And my wife had never been. I, of course, have been one other time. But it's a shocking thing when you recognize and realize you're in the land of the Lord. Tel Aviv is a very modern-looking city, much like you might think of New York or Los Angeles, Chicago. It looks like a thriving metropolis. And I think it's sort of the economic center of Israel. It's a university town and quite secular, perhaps more secular than other places, of course. But it was neat to fly in there and not have a huge agenda that first evening.
Agree. And we have to just mention quickly that the sign in the bus was corrected to read the Alford Peter's tour. Folks, you're listening to a conversation with Pastor Chris and Pastor Carl talking about a recent trip, March 1 through 13, 2023. Carl, our first night was in Tel Aviv. We're up the next morning, but not too crazy early. And our first stop was the absolutely glorious Caesarea Maritima, one of our favorite places and notable for, several reasons, right?
Absolutely. It's where Peter met Cornelius in that wonderful scene in the book of Acts. It's also the place where the Apostle Paul was imprisoned for 2 years from Acts 23 to Acts 25 in the scriptures records this account. Chris, as you and I had two experiences there, 2018 and then this year, they had uncovered, since we had been there last, the prison.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes.
Where
yeah.
Paul was kept. Now, there was a sign there in 2018 that said, you know, Paul was imprisoned somewhere near here. So we were left to wonder. But they had found the arched doorway that led into a place believed to be the very prison where Paul was held for those 2 years. He was arrested in Jerusalem, brought to Caesarea Maritima, and then after 2 years taken to Rome. So just stunning to see that. And Chris, I must say that we stressed to our people the entire trip that the Holy Land preaches, that it speaks. And even the front of our bus and the sign that they had there that identified our tour preached. Because he who is first shall be last.
Yeah, I knew
let
you
us keep that in mind.
I knew you couldn't let that pass. We ought to probably mention, Carl, that after Jerusalem was destroyed, Caesarea became the, well, center of Christianity in that part of the world. And there was a council that was held there in just shy of the year 200. That was the place where they determined that Easter would be celebrated on a Sunday and fixed the date there. And there was a lot of argument between various parts of the church about that, even to this day, but that's where it was first nailed down.
Arguing solar or lunar dating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Chris, you've done an awful lot of study on King Herod. And one of the great, I guess, intrigues about Caesarea Maritima is Herod's stamp there. His thumbprint is all over that place. I wonder if you would just share a few thoughts about that.
Well, I do love the architecture and the history there. And, you know, I think as you and I were talking earlier today about your preparations for a study that you're showing your church, and you're going to juxtapose the palace that Herod built for himself just near Bethlehem with the humility of Bethlehem itself, I think you can say that there's this huge clash of kingdoms all over the place in the Holy Land between the Christ and the kingdom of Christ, and then Herod, who claimed to be and was named by the Romans the king of the Jews. So Herod the Great set up, or began building anyway, in about 22 BC, this new city and a harbor, and he built these massive I guess you'd call them breakwaters, that would hold like 300 ships. There was a sewage system, and it was very, very advanced, which is another thing that strikes me when you go to the Holy Land, especially you see these great palaces by Herod. At least I, growing up, was thinking about these things being very primitive and or these places being very primitive, but gosh, you look at that Olympic-sized swimming pool where the mosaics are still intact that Herod built there for his own palace at Caesarea, and you just wonder at the expense and the pageantry of it. Caesarea has been dubbed the Vegas on the Med because,
yes,
at least at the time, they had an amphitheater. 20,000 people are watching chariot races. There's a hippodrome there. There's gladiatorial combats. It became an important port for trade and so on. And so it's really, in some ways, a very modern, if I can use that word, place.
And it's interesting to note that the restrooms there were outdoors and at the entrance, really, to the chariot racing facility they have right on the Mediterranean. And it was pointed out to us by one of the guides that instead of, hey, let's do lunch, that the people of that day would have said, hey, let's go to the outdoor restrooms together.
And they sit
on Tuesday.
Yeah, and they sit together and they talk. and it's literally in the gates of the city, so to speak. And so I guess it's a social sort of thing. Glad we don't do that now.
We had several of our ladies who modeled that for us as we, and we got pictures of that have shown up in the slideshow. Of course, they were fully clothed and there was nothing going on, but it just was quite funny.
Carl, our next stop was after a short drive over to Mount Carmel. Now, Mount Carmel isn't just one mountain. It's a mountain range, and it's in northern Israel. And it goes all the way from the Mediterranean Sea down toward the southeast, so kind of diagonal there. But we know Mount Carmel because, well, most of all, it was the scene of a really big showdown in the Old Testament, yeah?
Yes, as we know, it was Jesus who established Sunday as the day of worship for Christians, but it was there on Mount Carmel that the ice cream sundae first became popular.
Beautiful. I was hoping you'd get that in there. Yeah, because caramel, it doesn't mean caramel, Carl.
No.
Caramel actually means garden land or vineyard of God. So it's a very lush sort of place. But I'm thinking, you know what I'm thinking about.
Elijah and the prophets of Baal had a showdown, and there were two altars there. One Elijah was manning, and the prophets of Baal the other.
Yeah.
And they put their sacrifice on their altar and wanted to demonstrate that their God or gods were the real ones and that Yahweh was fake and phony and false. So they began to dance around and call down the power of their God, and nothing happened. And Elijah, and I love the way you do this, so I'm going to defer to you on this, Chris. You noted how Elijah was, he demonstrated his sense of humor in responding to these idiots who were dancing around cutting themselves. Tell us what Elijah said to them.
Well, he must have been very sure in his faith, right? Because he's taunting them the whole time. And if you read the Bible text carefully, he even says something to the effect of, hey, maybe your God's traveling vacation. Maybe he's in the bathroom. Speaking of bathrooms, Carl, there's an idea coming back around. And then he simply contrasts all of their jumping around, cutting themselves and all that with a humble prayer. Lord, show these people that you are God in Israel, and then you know the rest of the story.
Once again, we see the competing kingdoms, and we see how one is loud and boisterous and accepted by the masses, and yet it's powerless. In its grandiosity, it is powerless, and yet we see the humble prayer of God's prophet raining down fire that consumes not only his thrice watered sacrifice, but also burning up the priests of Baal and that sacrifice.
One other thinking, that part is not humorous, but as I think about Elijah taunting them, that's funny to me. I think I've told you this before, but my mother used to just read me stories out of the Bible, and I particularly loved hearing about all the exploits of Elijah and Elisha. And one of my favorite stories also involves Mount Carmel, but this time with Elisha. I'll bet you remember the episode, but according to the Book of Kings, Elisha traveled to Carmel straight after cursing a group of young men because they'd mocked him. Remember? They said, hey, go on up, Baldy. And then a bear came out and mauled them. That just, as a kid, struck me as so funny. I guess I have a weird sense of humor. But I'll never forget that particular part of the world for that story. We should say that from the 12th century to the present, there's a Roman Catholic religious order that was founded on Mount Carmel. They're named the Carmelites, right, in reference to that mountain. Can't remember who the founder was off the top of my head, but one of the things about that particular group is that they are called discalced Carmelites. So that means that they don't wear shoes. So that's the site of where you hear the word Carmelite. If you hear something about a Carmelite monastery or a Carmelite order, it comes from right there.
And that may be why so many in Kentucky do not wear shoes. We may be Carmelites.
Very holy people, folks from Kentucky, yes. I think. Don't you, Carl?
Absolutely. You know, the other interesting thing to note at Mount Carmel, as you move from the monument to Elijah, around behind the church that has been built there as a sacred site, you move to a platform where you can overlook Megiddo or Armageddon. Armageddon shows up one time in the New Testament in Revelation 16, verse 16, and it speaks, again, of the powers of this world in conflict with God and his great power and his forces. And this battle is anticipated by many to be the final battle of the age. And God will certainly prevail, and the blood will run very deep in that valley. And it's an eerie-looking valley. When we were there, there was sort of a misty haze over the entire valley, so it was a very moody kind of sense as we looked out over the horizon.
Yeah, and it's huge. In Israel, you think about things being very compact and so on, and you get up to the top of this mountain and you look down and there's this enormous valley. It reminds me of California in some ways, stretching as far as you can see left and right and a pretty good distance across. And you really get a sense of the scope of it all. Our next stop on the way to the Sea of Galilee, and we'll save the Sea of Galilee and its various points of interest for our next podcast. We wanted Carl at least to have a drive-by through or by Nazareth, yes?
Yes, and I think it's one of the compromises we made. We wanted to try to carve out as much time as we could in the places that we knew would be very, very special. And in Nazareth, we were hoping maybe to go by the boyhood home of Jesus. I don't think we really know that it's his boyhood home, but that's sort of the traditional view. And we kind of ran out of time, and so we made that a drive-by. So, Chris, I know there were several things that we took note of on the way by. A particular mountain came into view as we drove by.
Yeah, that is the spot where traditionally folks believe Jesus was taken after his provocative statements at the synagogue there, and they wanted to throw him off the cliff. He eluded their grasp, but there are some cliffs there, kind of look like a quarry in some ways, just outside of Nazareth. And that's the spot that they say that occurred. These days, Nazareth is known as the Arab capital of Israel. And the inhabitants are predominantly Arab citizens, and a minority is Christian, which ironically is what's happening also in Bethlehem. And I realize that's a different podcast, but we'll talk about that at some point as well.
Indeed. And if we could just go back to Mount Carmel for one second,
I want
to acknowledge Dr. Teresa Gardner. She often brings an artistic flair to our teaching. And while we were up there looking over Armageddon, but reflecting back on Elijah and the priests of Baal and that whole experience, she unpacked this beautiful silk cloth, mm-hmm. and we had several people hold it and move it. There was tremendous wind up there, but our group danced underneath this fiery-looking piece of cloth, and just to remind everyone of God's power and his spirit falling, if you will, in purifying fire, and that's just one of those things that Teresa brings that's unique. I don't know of any other tour group these experiences, and she brings that to our tour. We were blessed to have her with us.
And it was an opportunity simply to pray, God, what are some places in our lives that need to be burned away? And what might that look like on this trip even? What are you interested in doing in my
life? Another example of how the land preaches.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, very good. Very good.
Folks, you're listening to a conversation with the marvelous Dr. Carl Peters, my very best friend in the world and someone I consider my pastor. He and I recently headed up a trip to the Holy Land, March 1 through 13. Gosh, we've just been home a couple of weeks. By the way, Carl, is your jet lag back to normal? You know, I had three additional hours that you didn't have to wrestle with, but golly, it hit me hard this time.
It was about 2 weeks worth of feeling like at 3 o'clock every day I was ready for bed. But I'm about back to normal.
Yeah,
now.
Me too. Sheila and I called it the wall every afternoon about 3 or 4 o'clock. And then at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm going, hey, it's a happy day. Let's go do something fun. And she said, no.
Well, you know, every day we were there, I hit a wall every morning when I walked out and saw the front of the bus and that sign on the front of the bus. But that's a topic for another podcast.
You're perhaps not bitter about that in any way, are you, Carl?
No, my therapist is helping me.
Good.
I'm okay.
Good.
Yeah.
Our last stop before we got to the beautiful Sea of Galilee was Cana of Galilee. And Carl, this was one of those places where we didn't go last time, but because of its special nature and import in our own preaching and teaching, we said, nope, we got to go there. And we got out of the bus and we looked at an especially beautiful church there. And of course, folks will remember that that's the location of the marriage at Cana, where Jesus takes the water and in a beautiful miracle turns it into wine. That's in the Gospel of John. So many wonderful, theological things happen in that story, don't they, Carl?
Yes, John chapter 2 is where that can be found, the very first part of that chapter. What was interesting as well, Chris, as we ended our powwow out in the courtyard, kind of setting up for everybody what to expect when they went in, we walked in, we snuck in really, because the doors were shut. We looked over at a monk over on the side, kind of protecting it. He gave us the go ahead to go in. We went in very quietly, and there was a double wedding going on while we were there. A double wedding. It was a double blessing to see that. There was a bride and groom on each side of the chancel there. And then we went around to the side and had our own teaching time where we brought out the connection with you all who were on the trip. Remember the connection with Genesis 1 in the beginning and John 1 in the beginning, the series of days and so forth, how God finished his creation in Genesis chapter 2 with the coming together of Adam and Eve in their marriage, God presiding over the first wedding, and how in John chapter 2, after a series of days, John 1:29, 1:35, 1:42, it says the next day, and then John 2, it says on the third day, so we showed how that's a series that makes 7 days, and on the seventh day, Jesus is at a wedding where he performs his first miracle and ushers in, really, his ministry of bringing about the new creation. So these parallels are just precious. This was the first sign that Jesus performed, the first miracle. Through the Gospel of John, there are, I believe, 7 or 8 signs, depending on how you count them. But we showed how 8 is the number of the divine recapitulation and recreation. It's just so rich. And we talked about how the land preaches. This church at Cana of Galilee and that story located there preached to us very loudly of Jesus' ultimate bringing about of the new creation. Even in the midst of difficulties in this earth, the couple didn't have any wine, they'd run out of wine. Why, that's no problem for Jesus. One other point to bring up here, Chris, and that is when Mary realizes they have no wine, she comes to Jesus with this issue. And Jesus says something very interesting. He calls his mother woman. He says, "Woman, what have I to do with you? My time has not yet come."
By the way, if you ever just looked at your mom and said, "Woman,"
I would have been backhanded into next week.
Well, it happened at our house. Noah said that to his mother when he was very, very young. "Woman, what are you doing?" And, well, she may look small and friendly, but she can, dish it out. Why did Jesus say that, Carl? Tell us about that.
Well, it's just fascinating to me that if you go all the way back to Genesis 3:15, the Proto-Evangelium, you have God identifying that he is going to bring about the new creation that has been ruined by Adam and Eve. He's going to bring it about by a woman and her offspring. And the woman and her offspring, though the heel of the seed of the woman will be bruised, he will crush the serpent's head. We know the serpent is Satan.
Amen.
Well, who is this woman? Well, Jesus identifies the woman in John chapter 2, but more importantly, in John 19 at the cross.
There you go.
When he commends to John, the apostle whom he loved, he says, "Woman, behold your son," and to John, "Behold your mother."
Beautiful.
And so at the very point where Jesus fulfills Genesis 3:15 in this first glimpse of the gospel, we see the woman and her seed, the son, who's dying. He's bruised. He's going to rise on the third day. So he's not overcome, but he is crushing the serpent's head in that moment.
We took just a few moments to point out some beautiful parallels in the Jewish wedding ceremony with Jesus and his bride, the church. The groom will go away after proposing to prepare a place for the bride. She keeps her lamp trimmed and ready, waiting for his return. But one of the little vignettes that's so sweet to me is that in the Jewish wedding ceremony, the bridegroom will extend the cup to the bride. And when she takes the bride, the covenant is made. And fast forward, of course, to the Lord's Supper, where our bridegroom extends the cup to us. And that points then to the proleptic part of all this, Carl, when one day there's going to be an incredible wedding feast.
Oh, very well said. These connections will animate, will bring life and energy and meaning to our celebration at table if we will have eyes to see and ears to hear.
Indeed. Carl, in our next installment of these podcasts, we're going to talk about our time over at the Sea of Galilee. From Cana, we drove a short way over to what was really just kind of a scroungy and ratty hotel. It was just really...
Just, yeah, it was horrible.
It was really awful there on the seaside. We'll talk about that next time. But before we go, Carl, I have to say, picking up on something you just mentioned there at the end, all of these things have really been flooding through my mind as I'm preparing for, oh, I don't know, teaching sermons or just day-to-day living. It really does have a way of, I think you use the word animate, the way we go about our lives as Christians, yeah?
Indeed. Everything that happened to us in the Holy Land is now springing from the pages of the scriptures for me. And as I read the scriptures to prepare for teaching or for Sunday morning, they take on a new life. And I think everyone on our trip would agree with that in their Bible study. One thing that keeps recurring in discussing this with folks who were on the trip, they said it was life-changing. And I must agree.
Folks, next time we're going to talk about the Sea of Galilee and a whole boatload of wonderful experiences that we had there. In the meantime, I'm Pastor Chris. The more learned and handsome one on the other end of the line is Carl Peters, my dear friend. We did this trip together, and we're going to do a series of podcasts to kind of break it down a little bit. Carl, love you. Bless you.
Thank you. Bless you, sir. Thanks for having me.